everyone. Welcome back to the 21 and Sensory podcast with me, Emily. And on today's episode, I have a very special guest. I have Dr. Camilla Pang. You may or may not have heard of her, but I'm going to do a little introduction to her. So Camilla holds a PhD in biochemistry from University College London and is a postdoctoral scientist who specialises in translational bioinformatics. Camilla is blessed with the solid combination of ASD, ADHD and PhD, which is a line that I stole from her website because I just absolutely love it. And she is driven by her passion for understanding humans, our behaviours and how we work. Camilla is the award-winning author of Explaining Humans, which through a set of scientific principles examines life's everyday interactions. Her book won the Royal Society Insight Investment Science Book Award in 2020. And she was the youngest writer ever to win the prize and the first writer of colour. She has a new children's book out in March 2022, which is super exciting. And she's also a speaker, a neurodiversity advocate, and does a range of charity and voluntary work. So we're going to have a lot to talk about. So Camilla, do you want to say hi?
Oh, hi. Thanks for that lovely introduction. Goodness. I don't know where to start. And thank you so much for having me on here. I'm really honoured to be on here. It's one of my favourite podcasts. So excited.
Thank you. I'm going to use that soundbite for the rest of... No, joking. She says it's her favourite podcast ever. Thank you. So usually we start the podcast with a kind of, I don't know, a little bit more kind of background on you. But I don't know if you want to explain what you're kind of up to right now. And then maybe we'll talk about your diagnoses of autism and ADHD.
That sound good, yeah. So basically, right now, so I've actually just terminated my job at a pharmaceutical company quite recently so that I could just go full-time writing for the two books just for a few months, just so I could just get them in the bag, focus on them, and then go back to a science job again when I can have more time to do it. So So currently, but then I'm also volunteering as a researcher for the Francis Crick / UCL in the meantime, just to keep me in the kind of like science brain and get my, I call it my protein fix. So like studying proteins is like one of my favorite things to do. I know that sounds like really weird to some people, but like I love them and I will continue to love them. I write about them. And so currently I just wrote my children's book, which is out in mid-March, 17th of March, and I'm currently writing another book, which is currently secret.
Exciting. I didn't realise you were doing another book as well. Oh, exciting.
Should be good, yeah, hopefully. Hopefully.
Well, I'm glad you've kind of, in a way, like you said, like stepped away from that other job so that you can have more time, because one of my questions was, how do you juggle all these things? It's a lot of things.
Yeah, well, it's weird actually. It's a great question, because I actually find it quite hard to focus now I have fewer things, and I think it's because I love to have many things going on so I can focus, because it's that conundrum of, if you make time for something I have all day to do this, so you won't do it. With me, if I have like less time to do things, then I'm more likely to focus. So for me, I worked in the day as a scientist, and in the evening I did my writing. And I think it's just being, I wouldn't say consistent, because it's knowing when you write best. It's also knowing that on weekends you might want to write for pleasure, and that's part of it. I think a lot of people be like, oh no, you need to focus entirely on your writing and it's got to be essay format. But a lot of writing is just an assembly of ideas, and I think you can do that at any time.
That's really interesting that you say that it kind of focuses you to have more things. And I guess, obviously, I'm saying like, oh, you've got so many things going on, but they're all things that you're passionate about. And does that make it feel like less like work if you're kind of passionate about them?
Yeah, no, completely. I think it doesn't feel like work. And if I describe to you what I do in a day, I wouldn't actually call it work. I feel like, oh, I haven't done any work today. And that's because I really love what I do. And I'm almost intimately linked with the process of writing and also my love for science. It's almost something that I don't really feel as separate to me. But then I get really tired and not know why. So I think it's when you do something that you love to such an extent, you don't call it work. And I know that sounds really cliche, but it's kind of true.
No, I think it's really nice to hear from someone that has found that balance of something that it doesn't feel like work, and maybe you're not, you know, like worried on a Sunday evening to start a new week kind of thing. It's really nice that you've found that kind of passion and that you enjoy it. That's the main thing.
Yeah, and it's weird because so I'm actually volunteering, like I say, as a scientist for the Cricket UCL, and that's voluntary. That's not even paid. So, and I'm doing that because it's like an extension of my PhD project, and from years ago, and it's a collaboration I set up. But I'm completely in love with the subject, and I really believe in it being something. And that alone just makes me be like, yeah, I'm going to spend 2 hours on it this evening.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
I love it.
Oh, that's good. That's really nice to hear, because I feel like a lot of the time it can be really hard to settle on, you know, something that you want to do for work, and to find it like pleasurable at the same time is really good. So to go back a bit, your kind of diagnosis of autism came way before your diagnosis of ADHD. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, that's right. And it's quite interesting because there are overlapping symptoms. And this is one of the reasons why I think the neurodiversity model of symptoms as opposed to labels of certain you know, conditions is probably a little bit better now. But when I was little, I still have autism now, but I got diagnosed when I was 8. Mm-hmm. And I just found the sensory and logistical part of life very challenging. Like I was saying to my friend the other day, of how, like, you know, how do you expect me to learn when A, I'm sat next to a smelly person, I've been on a smelly bus that's got weird noises and weird people on, I don't want to even go to school, and mm-hmm. and why is there bells every an hour and there's crowds? I'm like, why would I want to do that? And so I feel like a lot of the things that kind of would bother people, but they would turn a blind eye at because they're not big things, are actually really big things for people who are, you know, who have hypersensitivity, such mm-hmm. as autism. And so my mum was like, okay, she's getting exhausted for almost no reason, but clearly the reason was I just found it very difficult environmental wise, and getting on the bus every morning wasn't something that I could do. The ADHD, however, came on later in life when I had to work in a 9-to-5 job. Lovely, lovely job, lovely people. Everything was fine. So what was wrong? Why was I having panic attacks every lunchtime if I didn't go for a walk, or if I couldn't sit still? I had to have a standing desk, and I found it difficult to focus in meetings. I either was hyperactive or I fell asleep, which isn't ideal in front of your boss, genuinely. Mm-hmm. But I was like, instead of spinning inwards, which is how I felt like I was having an autistic meltdown, I would spin outwards, and I felt like nothing was enough, but also too much. I felt dizzy in my own thoughts. Okay. And I was anxious, and so I thought, this is normal. And so I spoke to occupational health, and then I haven't yet actually got a formal diagnosis because the NHS they're trying to get a diagnosis is very difficult, but I've had lots of like mini pre-official diagnosis saying that I have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, that's when I've actually realized.
Okay, because I was literally going to ask you, my next question was like, how did you find the assessment process and like waiting times and stuff? But you've already kind of touched upon that for your ADHD diagnosis.
Yeah, it's very difficult, actually. I think this is something a lot of people, including quite a few of my friends, have found, is that it's really difficult to support ADHD diagnosis, which don't fit the kind of specific criteria, mainly, you know, benchmarked on men, but also if you're not ADHD enough. So I think a lot of people feel the need to almost play up their ADHD symptoms so that they can tell themselves and others that they need support. Mm. And I know that sounds like they're not playing it up, but in my head, I'm like, I almost wish someone could just see me that I have ADHD so that they know that it's something that I really struggle with and need help with. It's not just for attention. So it's not for attention, but you know, it's something that it's a hard process. And I really feel for those people who haven't yet got the support.
Yeah, definitely. And I kind of feel like you've sort of touched upon it a bit then, but do you almost feel that you kind of mask things so well that, like you were saying, you kind of wanted to people to really be able to see the ADHD in you, but actually are you quite the kind of master of masking?
This is a great question, and it's something that I've recently asked myself because I've actually read a really good book that I've just reviewed called, I think it's called Unmasking Autism, and it's very, very good. It's by Devon Price. But the more I realise that I'm kind of trying to make excuses for my behaviour to myself, the more I realise that I'm masking, and sometimes mm-hmm. I don't, like the same, how are you supposed to ignore your instincts and function? Because for me, ignoring instincts, that would mean like ignoring the instinct to dance randomly in the middle of the street is the same instinct of searching for food. Mm-hmm. And I think this is like, how do you differentiate between the two? Both of them feel right, but one of them is acceptable. And when I kind of read Unmasking Autism, I didn't realize how much I was masking. And you don't want to show people your full self, because as much as you are strong and confident, and I am, I'm at peace with myself, it still hurts when someone sees the full of you and then goes, I'm actually all right, thanks, bye. Like, mm-hmm. we're still human. And I think this is why people don't want to unmask, and I don't blame them. But I think in order to attract the right people and to do the right things and to do what we want in life, we need to unmask so that we can actually know what we want and not deny ourselves what we actually want and are. Mm-hmm.
No, I definitely agree with that. And also, I just feel like, I don't know, just to fit in the world, you feel like you have to suppress yourself and almost like water yourself down a bit in terms of like autism and maybe your ADHD as well. Mm. And I feel like actually, if people just know you as who you are, they should get to kind of the stage where they just accept you for who you are and accept that this is your normal. Whereas like for me at work, I feel like I have to suppress myself so much just to feel like I'm kind of normal and fitting in. Whereas actually, I'd be way more comfortable if, I don't know, if I could just be myself and be like, look, this is me, this is Emily, just, you're going to have to learn to deal with me.
Yeah, no, I think there is a fine balance. And I think especially if you don't want to cause trouble at work. The last thing you want to be labelled as is, oh, she's neurodiverse. She's, you know, she's a troublemaker. Mm. You don't want that. It's the last thing you want. You actually want to be just seen as a person and not the effect that you have on people's levels of acceptance. I do, however, think that it's good to stand up for yourself and what you need. So for example, like my boss at my old job, he was great, he was really understanding, and he could tell that I was actually getting quite heated up about like and anxious about how, I don't know, explain this code to me. Okay, it was someone else's code, and I just suddenly felt the pressure to perform and do it and do it there and then and know everything. And mm-hmm. and then I was like, I'm getting anxious, James. And he was like, okay, just take 5 minutes out and we'll come back, have a cup of tea, and we'll go again. Like, he didn't even make it a thing. So I feel like it's not like everyone needs to read a whole Bible to understand you. Yeah. It's just so complicated. It's just people actually being nice and knowing that mm-hmm. we go at a different pace, and that pace is sometimes fast and sometimes slow.
Mm-hmm. That's so nice to hear that, you know, just that's all you need is that little step away. Exactly. And how did you find kind of your experience within the education system? Like after your like autism diagnosis, did you get any form of like support through like primary and secondary school at all? Like, do you feel like you had access to that sort of thing or?
Yeah, I was very lucky in that regard, because I actually had epilepsy when I was little. And so what that meant was that my parents paid a very close eye on me and my education and support needed to catch up. But in that, they actually found that I was autistic and I had an assessment, and they kind of talked about the things I found difficult. And I ended up having a mentor that would help organise me and explain things to me in a way that I'd understand. And translate things. And I think stepwise, nothing nuanced, just this is what I need to do, this is why I need to do it, and that's it. And mm-hmm. I think by doing that and knowing what's expected of me was gave me a platform to kind of shelter on while I learned the things that I really enjoyed learning and dealt with things like bullying. It gave me that kind of foundation I needed to survive in school. And I had that all the way throughout, you know, sixth form and uni. I had like a mentor who I saw maybe once every 2 days, and it really helped. And now I don't need one. And mm-hmm. and that's amazing. And sometimes I need, someone to help me organize my life, just be like, what's happening? But that's it's incredible how a lot of people feel like when they have support, it's like, oh, I'm going to have support for the rest of my life. And I'm like, well, actually, that isn't the case. Sometimes you need support for in a definite amount of time so that you can build the mechanisms slowly, piece by piece. Mm-hmm. And then one day you'll need less of them, and then you'll need more, and then you need even less. So it's about knowing that it's a process.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realise about when you get your diagnosis, is that, like, when I got mine, they gave me like a support level at that time. But the assessor was like, this can change. This is like a very fluid thing that, you know, like you said, you might need support at, you know, some points in your life more than others. And it's very much a kind of fluid thing that, you know, you might need more at a certain point than at another point, or, you know, just in order to, you know, live independently or, you know, something like that. But I think a lot of people just don't realise that, you know, it's not something that's static, if that makes sense.
Exactly. And this is the thing. It's a bit like, and that's the thing. You want to, you take it literally, don't you? You're like, okay, I need this support. I need it every day, constantly. Mm-hmm. And naturally, but I think the whole art of it is actually knowing what you need when in different situations. And that can be done. Even if you take things literally like me, you can try and fragment the kind of support you need in different situations based on how you feel. And then before you know it, you know that you can be flexible to your needs and know what you need. And that is one of the biggest empowerments I've had, isn't the PhD and all that. It's actually knowing what I need and in different situations. Not all the time, not every time, but just being like, oh, wait a minute, hang on a minute. I'm anxious. I don't know why, but I'm anxious. Okay, let's just take a step back. Let's carry on what I'm doing. Okay, I can't focus. Okay, that's fine then. What we're going to do is go for a walk. You don't know what you need, but what we need is air, time, and space. And I think that helps you elucidate a bit more about how you operate to yourself, as opposed to depend on like a solid concrete routine or a person to tell you that you're okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that's half the battle, is knowing what you need in a moment.
That's hard. Yeah, that's very hard.
It's so difficult. Like sometimes I'll need like a family member or a friend to be like, Emily, I think actually you'd benefit from doing this.
Yeah.
And if it's not in front of you, you just don't realize it sometimes. And
it's so
yeah.
So good that.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? But yeah. It's, you know, having these little mechanisms, like coping, you know, mechanisms in place, like you're saying, like, you don't know what you need, but actually if you just go out for a walk, that's kind of half the battle, in that you're getting out and away from your space, and you might be able to work it out then.
And if not, then that's okay, just carry on. And if you can't, for whatever reason, I think it's easing expectations of yourself so that you can figure out what is wrong, and then be like, oh, wait a minute, hang on a minute, I saw my friends 2 days ago, and even though I really enjoyed seeing them, I was in a really loud place. Mm-hmm. I think I'm still a little bit traumatized from that. And allowing yourself to admit that, because a lot of people are like, oh, I couldn't be traumatized by that. I'm not that silly, I'm not that sensitive. That's for silly people. But actually, I've got a social hangover from 2 days ago, not because the person wasn't, wasn't icy, you know, they were lovely, but the place was so loud and so sensory overload. Mm. I went with the flow, and I looked like I wasn't bothered, and I wasn't, but I kept it in, and now only 2 days later it's coming out, and I wonder why I'm so restless, and it's because I'm still responding to sensory overload 2 days ago.
Exactly. And like, I feel like you have to be your own detective all the time. You have to constantly go back and think, what could be, you know, why am I feeling like this, what, you know, and to go back and, like you said, be like, oh, actually, I bet you it's from when I met up with this friend a couple of days ago and stuff like that. You have to be your own, like, detective all the time and try and work out why you're burnt out. And it's a lot.
That's so true. It's a really good point. And admitting to yourself what you find difficult. Like, it's, and I think that's where you need to stop self-shaming. A lot of people, like, I don't want to do that and know what they need, because what they actually need, they're ashamed of being responsive to big lights and loud sounds. They're like, oh, that's not me, but let's face it, it is.
Yeah. And have you always been aware of your kind of, like, you know, sensory struggles and stuff like that, or is that something that you've kind of come to realize about yourself?
It's weird. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Like, for that, I could have blamed my restlessness today on something really small that has happened today, but actually I think over time like I say, with the self-shaming, you start to gather a bit more about what you respond to and what you're internalizing. For me, mm-hmm. it's about, okay, how much am I internalizing and why, and how much energy is it taken from me? Okay, maybe I should remember this feeling. It isn't about what I respond to, it's how much I'm holding in. And for that, you need to know that that'll pay back, that'll come back later as an anxiety attack. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's not like, oh, I'm responding to this environment and I'm feeling really overwhelmed. You shut down.
Yeah.
And that's where it's really difficult, because you shut down in the places where you should be paying attention. But I think it's knowing these places where you shut down, where you have to internalize, where you have to turtle, I call it, and then write those down. But like, when have I turtled today? This shows when I'm actually being affected and internalizing things to mask.
Mm-hmm. I might have to use that, turtling. That makes, like, it's such a good visual, like exactly what you do, like retreat into yourself kind of thing.
Yeah.
Let's chat about your books. Obviously, you've written Explaining Humans and your new book, Perfectly Weird, Perfectly You, which is out in mid-March, like you said, and that's a children's book. So what was the process like in terms of writing, you know, to kind of two different audiences, if that makes sense, for like different books? Was it kind of like a tricky sort of switch?
No, I think I really enjoyed it, because mm-hmm. I think with children, you have to make things very clear, very simple, and very to the point. And what I really wanted, actually, because I did some research of children's books, and there were some great, great ones out there. And I think what I wanted was to be quite an honest guide, because I think some of the books can contain a lot of motivational quotes, which are quite, which I don't even understand, and I'm nearly 30, like, follow your dreams. I'm like, what does that even mean? I don't know what it means. It's too vague. It's like, oh yeah, be your best self. And I'm like, oh great, cheers. Like, what does that even mean?
So it's not helpful, is it?
Yeah. Not really helpful. And I'm like, cheers, but I'm not going to be the one. So what I try to do in mine is kind of break that down further so that they do understand what those quotes mean and mm-hmm. what they mean in fundamental terms in you know, living as yourself, owning your own process. What does confidence mean? What does managing your emotions mean? What does this mean in terms of the weather and the scientific principles that are kind of encouraged to learn in key stage 2 and 3? With adults, you can kind of elaborate on your kind of tone to make it more nuanced and, you know, context driven and make it come alive. But with children, you have to make it come alive through a different way. You can't use arty farty language. You have mm-hmm. to awaken them through the fundamentals of what you're trying to say, and for that it needs to be very relatable and very honest and to the point. And I really enjoyed that, because to be honest, I could have done with that when I was little. Mm-hmm.
I think it's really nice that you've picked up on what didn't work for you, and also like the stuff you're saying about quotes is so true. They're so like wishy-washy and so like not specific enough, that the fact that you're, you know, actually taking the time to, you know, potentially explain things a little bit more in your book sounds way more clear.
Yeah, I hope so. I really hope so. I'm actually more nervous about this one than the next one, because children are, you know, the most honest and harsh mm-hmm. critics, because they'll tell you. And also they remember, even when they grow up to be adults, you'll be like, oh yeah, you wrote that book, didn't you? You know,
it follows you. Yeah.
It follows you. And so I really hope that they find it useful and not too wishy-washy, but to the point, and that they can relate to it and map their lives on it. Because I think this is one of the things I find hard in books, is to be able to map my own life on it and identify with it and use it.
And in kind of the process of writing these books, how, as an author, do you kind of like, do you have like a routine and a structure to your time, or do you very much, I'm always interested to know if like authors have a kind of structure to their day or not, or if they kind of write as it comes, like how do you write? That's quite a big question.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, because I don't think so for me, my brain is very prone to being jinxed. So if you tell me to do something, I won't do it. Mm-hmm. And that and I've had to try and navigate my way around that by pinballing my way into productivity. And that is through not putting any pressure on myself. Because if mm-hmm. I say I have to do this, this, and this, my brain will go, ha, no, you're not. And I'm like, oh no, you've jinxed it. So so I spend most of my time doing, be like, okay, it'd be nice today if we did some writing at some point. Let's take the dog out for a walk. Let's try and, you know, oh, wait a minute. That's, and what I do is like put in mini meetings for myself, because I'm very good at writing when I know I have an escape. Okay. And so I plan to have lunch early, even though I end up having it late, because I end up writing like an hour before lunch. And then because it's only an hour, it's, for me, I find that a lot easier to concentrate, because I could go at any time. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that ADHD element of it is definitely quite present. I don't write with a specific goal in mind. I'm a bit of a gardener writer, where you just kind of write things that you think, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's a great idea, concept for a chapter. Oh, I like that word. So it's all very like small and big and medium, all on the same page. It's not organized at all.
Okay.
And I think this is both overwhelming but also quite good, because it gives you a possibility to assemble things in a different way. If I said to you, oh, write it in this format and I want this out of it, it's kind of too specialized for me to work my magic. And I think over time, in order for you to write and get those kind of magical kind of like threads, you kind of need to be explorative.
Yeah, I guess if you're having to, I don't know, if you write like strictly in chapters and stuff, I feel like maybe that would kind of like narrow your field potentially. Whereas if you're writing, as you said, in a kind of gardeny kind of way.
Yeah. Then if someone says to you, these are the chapters that you need and these are the criteria, you need to write about, so what's one of the chapters? Okay. Computer, you need to write about arguments and make this relevant to science for children of key stage two. I'll be like, okay, cool. Let's Google key stage two science. How does it relate to computers? Okay, computers, blah, 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 blah. Wait a minute. When I was that age, I wanted to start querying things a lot more. Okay, I love asking and answering questions. And then it turned into a chapter on confidence. And so you kind of go around the dartboard. You look where you're throwing, but ultimately you try and warm up first to the subjects you think are relevant, and then eventually you will hit the bullseye. Does that make any sense?
No, that definitely makes sense. It's really interesting to hear, because I don't know, I think maybe a lot of people have this like preconceived kind of idea that authors, you know, sit down and write like, you know, back to back pages and stuff. No. And they write it in order, and but I don't know why I even have that, you know, potential understanding, when actually it can be a much more like creative and like even like more visual process of just gathering thoughts and ideas and then going back to it. It's a very
reflexive process. And I think it's because a lot of people, when they look at writers, they have an imposter syndrome saying, oh, I couldn't do this. So they clearly know what they're doing. Spoiler alert, we really don't. And most of the time we're trying to figure out what we're doing and trying to make the most of what our writings into something that is publishable. And I think this goes for a lot of the processes, not just writing, but science, because we are trying to figure out what works. Because if we knew what works, everything would be solved by now.
That's very true. How do you find, like, obviously, you know, once you've written it and it goes to print and stuff like that, how do you find the kind of second bit that comes, which is the kind of promotion of it and the kind of like PR around it? Like, how do you find that as someone who's autistic and has ADHD? Like, do you feel like it can be quite overwhelming?
I think initially I did, because I didn't know what to expect. But now I know what to expect. I'm like, oh, okay. And I now I made a mode for myself. So for example, I used to kind of pre-plan everything and have like can you send me the interview questions before so I can optimize my answers so that you can get as much information as you can. Whereas now I'm like, actually, the best interviews aren't the ones that have the most accurate, you know, the most information per unit question. It's actually how well it flows. And I think it's acknowledging that it's not writing another book. It's actually talking about it in a very human, reflexive, fluid way. And even though you're like, well, how are you talking about fluidity and you're autistic? Well, yes, it is possible. And I think it's by taking the pressure off the performance mode and allowing yourself to enjoy the work that you've done and to talk about it in a way in which brings you joy, because that's kind of what it's about, really, isn't it?
Exactly. I like how you've kind of you've looked at it differently, and you've thought of it as a kind of, you know, it's the opportunity to really not like big up your work, but really talk about stuff that you're passionate about. And really, you know, the best way to do that, you're right, is, you know, not necessarily to script like your answers and stuff like that, even though it can be very tempting to do that. But actually, yeah, the way you come across and, you know, just like your passion within what you're talking about just comes across naturally if you, you know, answer off the cuff and things like that. So I get, yeah, I get where you're coming from.
It's good to script it. I think for the first few ones, I did script it because it did help me focus on what I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. So I think it is important to do that, especially in the first instances, to be like, okay, what do I want to say? These are topics I kind of want to cover. Let's kind of go for it and try and stick them in where we feel like they're appropriate, which is hard. Mm-hmm. But over time, you kind of get a palette to what questions are most appropriate for what answers. That's what I've learned anyway. And if you miss something that you don't, you know, and if, for example, right now, if I end up missing something that I want to talk about, usually they say, any other thing, any other thoughts?
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh yeah, actually, I forgot to mention this. So it's a lot more forgiven than you think, unless it's like a live radio interview, and that's a lot more nerve-wracking.
Yeah. I guess like there's varying degrees of like, you know, how like, I don't know, how much time you have as opposed to like, you know, like radio and TV stuff where it is quite, you know, like slots of time in which you've kind of got to get everything in.
Yeah, that's quite difficult, but then you have to, that takes a lot of focusing energy. Your brain's got to be on its best behavior, and you've got to get all the cards out and be like, yo, I know you don't want to do this, in the sense that you don't want to focus and be well behaved, but you got to hold my hand here. I think it's having that mode, and that takes a lot of energy and a lot of focus and a lot of work. And I call it my kind of like, what do I call it? I know what it feels like. It's when usually your mind's kind of running wild and all the animals are everywhere. And now you're like, yo, look, there's a thunderstorm happening. You're going to need to go in your barns. And they're like, you know what? Let's just do this for now. We'll chuck you a bone and we'll come out later. I'll be like, fine, just give me an hour. Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it takes a lot of energy, but I think it's quite an important skill to have. It's a bit like, I wouldn't say masking, but it is masking, but for the sake of communicating and focus, and it's getting all the animals into the barns so that you can focus. And for me, that's been quite useful.
Mm-hmm. I like that analogy.
There's a storm coming.
There's a storm. Get in. I kind of like to ask people what their kind of like hobbies and special interests are. I mean, do you feel like your kind of interests overlap with sort of obviously your work as an author and your work as a scientist? Do you feel like they kind of almost combine? Because I know you say you don't feel like you're working kind of thing, but do you have any kind of other hobbies that people might find interesting?
yeah, cool. No, so it's as well as like science and writing, I also I play the piano by ear, so I don't need music. I just kind of play and improvise, and it's one of my favorite things to do before bed and before I start my day. And I also really love, you know, to draw and to sketch, use acrylic paint. I just love transforming spaces so that I can put myself in them and be like, yo, this is how I feel. It's all about trying to identify with your environment, and those are my ways of doing it. I'm also big on my fitness. I love going for runs and spinning and swimming. I'm addicted to fitness in a healthy way now. I used to be in a very unhealthy way, and now I'm in a healthy way. And that's something that'd be quite interesting to talk about, actually, because I think a lot of people who have ADHD and autism, especially if you're a female, have a bit of a proclivity to have an obsession with exercise and potentially eating disorders. I think this is a taboo subject that not many people talk about, so I'm open to talking about that, because this is actually quite an important one to mention and to reassure the people who are listening, who are going through this, because it's not a nice place to be.
I definitely get what you mean about like certain things like exercise or something, like it might be kind of like an all or nothing kind of thing where you're just, you either
do everything or nothing. Otherwise, what's the point? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
it's not healthy, but it's just, I don't know, it's just how your brain is
Yeah.
Wired to think it's like I've got to be all in and dedicated to this or not at all.
And that's difficult 5 days a week. If you're training 5 days a week, you can't be all in. Otherwise, you'll have no energy left to do anything else.
Mm-hmm. And just giving yourself like rest days and stuff, which I know is like really important for like sports and things, so you don't get like injured. And
also your body gets quite tired. So I think this is quite an interesting one. I don't know whether to dip in and out of it, but I do think whoever is dealing with the kind of body dysmorphia, eating disorder for the sake of control, so that you have routine in your day, so that you feel like the less, you know, I haven't eaten lunch today, one point to me type mentality, because I've been there. I'm here holding your hand, and I'm there with you, and I want to make sure that it is a phase, and the more secure you get in your mechanisms, the less you'll have to rely on this mechanism of control, because you are enough as you are. You don't have to prove yourself by trying to make yourself smaller, because that is masking. I actually realized that. So me trying to control my weight via food and excessive exercise was actually my way of masking my autism to the world.
Do you feel like you were trying to fit in?
Yeah, literally, mentally and physically.
It's crazy, isn't it? You almost don't realize until you're like through it or out of it that the hindsight of being like, gosh, I really was wrapped up in that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a really hard place to be, because everything is about what you don't eat and what you have done workout wise, and everything you do, even if you can't even enjoy a holiday, because on the holiday you were thinking about what you shouldn't have ate or what you're not going to eat later on. Like, it takes over your day. And I think over time, the more you secure you are in your mechanisms of managing your emotions and allowing yourself to have time, you will over time be able to enjoy things again. Trust me.
Oh, that's nice to hear. It's nice to talk about it openly, because I feel like a lot of people, you know,
don't want to talk about it, which is why I'm like, this is actually really important. And I want, I've been through it, and I think it's really important that people know that it's okay.
Mm-hmm. I think also, like, the amount of people that I've talked to on this podcast, the amount of like people who have so many kind of overlaps with autism, not, you know, just like other neurodivergent conditions, but also just like comorbid things like, you know, anxiety and depression and anorexia and stuff.
Yeah.
And it really, really overlaps with autism and ADHD and things like that. And it's, I don't think it's talked about enough that there is this massive overlap, and that, you know, having this autistic mind when you're struggling with depression or anxiety or anorexia, you're a completely different patient to someone who is just dealing with anorexia, if that makes sense.
I think a lot, I think anorexia it's in my theories, it's supported by a book I've read, but it's a symptom of something else, in lack of control and anxiety. I think it's usually a manifestation of what needs to be dealt with, as opposed to it being the problem itself, much like many neurodivergent conditions.
Yeah, that's very true. I feel like we could talk about this for so long.
That's why I'm like, okay.
That's what I find difficult in a podcast, to like wrap up sections. Or you're like, this could be a podcast in itself. I mean, I guess I should obviously ask you, where can people buy your books, and where can they find out like more information about you?
So I've got, my Instagram is where I usually put like stuff like that. I've got a website, which I think it's my bio, creatively called www.camillapang.com.
Excellent.
Oh, because I can remember it then. I'm like, oh yeah. and that's quite useful, actually, just to kind of get an idea of people, like, hey, well, who's this? What's she done? Where can I buy her book? And you can click on the images, you can buy the book. I have linked to the Amazon page, although being honest, I'm kind of tempted just to direct it to the Waterstones, but it does depend on where you are. If there's no Waterstones in, you know, America, then it's quite difficult. So that's up to your consciousness, but I feel like Instagram's best, really. Or Twitter's quite good.
Yeah, okay. I will link everything you've just said below, in case people do want to follow you.
Cool.
And I'm going to ask you, is there anything else we want to talk about? Because you mentioned earlier that people usually ask that.
Thank you very much. It just so happens. No, I think I'm all right, really. I think, I haven't really have any agenda. I just think it's great to be on here, and I really hope that people feel less shame the things that they currently are masking to themselves, but nevertheless are controlled by. I think it's important to have a self, I wouldn't say not empathy, but a self-compassion, because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, no matter who you love and who you're with and what your family's like, you need to take care of you, because mm-hmm. you're gonna have to be in that body for a little while.
mm-hmm. And I feel like that's one of the great things about getting a diagnosis, is that you can kind of cut yourself some slack after you know that little bit more about yourself. You're like, exactly. Oh, I'm like this because of.
And then embrace it. You'll be like, I'm like this because I'm like this. So, that's why they love me. I read under my desk and my table at work, even if it's a standing desk, and I'm loving it because I don't want to sit in a chair.
Like, that sounds like such a good idea. Like a little den.
Like a den! Honestly, the best thing. It's so good.
Well, I don't know. I feel like that should just be an office thing. Like, because I don't understand open plan offices. I'm like, why can't we all just have like our own little spaces where, like, if we need to do like quiet work, like we can retreat to. And like, under the desk sounds like a great place.
<It's> brilliant. I recommend.
Everyone's now just going to be setting up dens in their offices, and their bosses are going to be like, what?
Yeah, I know.
Well, I thank you so much for being up for coming on this podcast, and I am very excited to read your new book and to hear that you're writing another one. Oh, exciting. Mm-hmm. So you literally can't say anything about that. Can you say if it's like a children's book or not?
Yeah, no, I can say a little bit. It's an adult science book that focuses more on the asking, like, cutting edge scientists that are in different fields on how they approach uncertainty and the scientific process. So it's basically trying to highlight that science isn't just a solution space that people can just dip into like a bag of sweets. It's actually a process, a painstaking process, where mm-hmm. it's a bit more of a business of inquiry. And it's taken people through that. And I think this is actually quite a good book.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I think, again, science is this big kind of, industry and topic that, if you're not in it, you don't know it, kind of thing. You don't know what the process is. And actually making it more accessible sounds great.
Yeah, making it more accessible and demystifying the things that a lot of people associate science with. And mm-hmm. yeah, hopefully they'll like it.
Oh, exciting. Do you know, like, I'm assuming you're still writing it, so you can't really say when it's going to be out.
Yeah, I can't really say that.
It's in the works, everyone.
Next year it'll be out.
Next year. Oh, that's so exciting. Oh, I look forward to that. I'm very excited to read your children's book.
It would be nice to see what you think of it, actually. Yeah.
I just, like, because I know you posted up some of the, like, illustrations that your illustrator had done, and they were, like, perfect. They looked so good.
Oh, good. Oh, she'll love that. No, she worked really hard on them, actually, to get them right. So I'm happy with them now. And, yes, off to print. Thank goodness.
Exciting. That must be nice. Is it exciting to see it in shops as well? Like, does that feeling wear off at all, or is it?
It is pretty cool.
Yeah.
It is pretty cool. I'm like, yo, hi me. I might move you to the front of the pile, you know.
I would just want to turn to everyone and be like, I wrote this.
Yeah. No, it is cool. It's interesting to see who will pick up the book and be like, oh, is she going to buy it? Oh, she's buying it. Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Are you just lurking in the shadows? Just like, who's going to
buy
it?
That's what I do, actually. That's my day job. No, it is nice though when people pick it up and they look at it and go, oh yeah, all right, I'll get that. It's like, yay, hope you like it.
Little win for you.
Yeah.
It's been lovely to have you on the podcast. And as I said before, I'll put all the links in the show notes so people can see where to follow you and where to buy your book as well. So yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Cheerio.